Hello, this is Don McPherson, your host of 12 Geniuses. Since beginning this podcast, I've been spending a lot more time thinking about the future. Not just a year from now or next decade, I'm thinking about the next 25 years of my life, the next 1,000 years of humanity, and beyond. So I'm excited to welcome back Dr. Bertalan Meschko to the show. We discuss his book, Your Map to the Future, and he shares how we can all become better futurists, even in a world of constant present-day disruptions. Dr. Meschko shares some of the methods that anyone can use to better prepare for the days and years ahead, and we talk about the benefits we can realize from being forward thinkers. Dr. Meschko is known as the medical futurist, so we end our conversation with his vision for the future of medicine and healthcare, and he shares his thoughts on how our understanding of aging will likely shift. Dr. Meschko, welcome back to 12 Geniuses.
The pleasure is mine, Don.
Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're doing, and then we'll get into your book. You've been on the show 2 times before, but we'll have some new listeners who haven't heard your episodes in the past.
Absolutely, I would be happy to. I'm a physician by training. I have a medical background, and my childhood dream was to become a scientist. So I finished my PhD in clinical genomics 2 years after finishing medical school. But immediately I felt that something was missing from my life. And as a scientist, I would love to have a special feature throughout my days, meaning that on one day, I would love to zoom into a very specific scientific research field. And then on the next day, I would love to zoom out and look at 20, 30 trends from a bird's eye high level perspective. And I had to find out what kind of research fields you can do that. And it's actually future studies. So 15 years ago, I switched to becoming a professional futurist. And since then, I've been working as the medical futurist. Of course, I'm not the only one creating content on that website or platform. I have a very dedicated small team, 12 people, and we create executive summaries, everyday social media, news analysis, YouTube videos, books, ebooks, videos, infographics. We have a range of content types that we create for almost 1 million followers worldwide. And at the same time, at the Medical Futurist Institute, I work with scientists around the world, and we try to publish in the highest level scientific journals about the evolution of digital health or what impact artificial intelligence, generative AI, all these advanced technologies could have on medicine and healthcare, and how we can better prepare decision makers, policy makers.
We're on the doorstep of the 2030s. Are you surprised at where we are compared to where you were as a medical student and your beginnings as a futurist?
The reason why I am is that change is never good or big enough. And while I have been anticipating the rise of empowered patients and empowered physicians, we even published papers and studies about that about a decade ago. But of course, it's still healthcare is never good enough. And while the evolution has been extraordinary, because we went from patients being on the most underused resources in healthcare to e-patients around the world becoming leaders of their own care and sitting at the same table where only medical professionals have been sitting for hundreds of years, if not thousands. All these have been great, but that's not good enough. So we are trying to positively influence policymakers, decision makers, regulatory agencies to make better decisions for patients and physicians, to really understand the context around all these technological changes and keep on focusing on the cultural aspects of this paradigm shift and not just every time on a specific.
We're going to talk about 2 topics today. The first topic is your book, Your Map to the Future. And the second topic is about aging and the future of aging. I want to ask you, why did you write Your Map to the Future?
I came to a realization last year. I became 40 years old and I, I guess everyone does that. I sort of reevaluated whether I'm doing the right thing, because I'd like to feel useful for the online community or global community of digital health and healthcare AI. And I had to come to the conclusion that while I do feel useful being the medical futurist, I could do something even more useful. And that would be sharing the actual methods that I have been using for over a decade, all the futures methods that I have been transforming into my own style and taste, with everyone else, not just with the digital health and medical and healthcare community, but with anyone who would love to just spend more time analyzing the future. And I was pretty surprised when I had this crazy idea. And I dived into the literature and I found many amazing books about the future. But I simply couldn't find one that would really make these futures methods as practical and digestible for even lay people as possible. So I thought that this is a niche, this is a gap that could be filled in. And I spent the next 9 months doing research about it and transforming these methods into really digestible, actionable steps. And then writing the book with all the stories and even with the kind of reasoning that the book goes through of why we have to get out of the trap of short-term thinking, why we have to create a new relationship with time.
When I started 12 Geniuses, a friend of mine said, you want to look at trends and you want to work with companies to help them understand what these trends are and how it's going to change their business and how it's going to change their industry. Nobody's going to want that. They're just focused on the day-to-day. They're just focused on getting through the day, getting through the week. And so my question to you is, in a time of constant disruptions, is looking into the future even possible?
It absolutely is, but we still don't do it. I mean, I think I list about at least 30 reasons why it makes a lot of sense now to spend more time thinking about or analyzing the future. But first, we have to understand why it's such a big deal, why almost nobody is doing that on a daily basis. Well, I think we are stuck between two opposite forces. Unless you or the listeners live in a forest without access to any kind of digital technologies. One force is called the fear of missing out. Of course, we always have to be connected. Otherwise, we will miss out something important, something huge, either in our personal or professional lives. And the second is called future shock. And you might be able to see the book behind me somewhere on the shelves from Alvin Toffler, my favorite futurist of all time, who wrote about the future shock back in the 1980s. And he called future shock the observation that the world has become so fast, especially from the era of personal computers, that we started living in a constant state of shock. The point I wanted to raise with this book is that it's absolutely possible to analyze the future with the right tools. And now answering your question, I'm sorry for being so long about the introduction to that. The futures methods have been used for about 5 decades by the futurist community, by economists, people in statistics, in business management. The foresight techniques have been around and think tanks have been using them for so many years. But for some reason, and I know what the reason is, but for some reason, these methods haven't found their way into the practical thinking of the average individual. And I think the reason why is that the future studies has been having a sort of PR problem. We know that these methods are incredibly useful. We have been showing them for countless times. But when it comes to whether we can describe like scenario analysis or the futures view or forecasting to a layperson, not futurists haven't had a good track record at being able to do so. So I thought that, what if I try to do that? Because essentially, that's what we at the Medical Futurists have been doing for over a decade. We have been transforming sometimes really complicated and challenging tasks and topics from digital therapeutics to digital front door companies, generative AI use for medical purposes. All these, we try to digest them and transform them into something, the context that everyone can understand. So when it comes to how to shape healthcare, the decision makers, the policy makers, physician and patient leaders, business leaders, developers, all of them will know what to do next because they understand the big picture context about these changes. I think the same can be achieved for general people about analyzing the future.
I have a great concern that the world is moving too fast for the average person. I'm looking into the future and this is what I'm doing almost on a day-to-day basis. You are doing it on a day-to-day basis. So you can understand the future better and probably are mentally prepared for the future. I don't know that the average citizen is. And I just wonder what is going to happen to our mental health as AI continues to explode and as we move toward fusion energy and as we move toward quantum. What's your thought there? And we become interplanetary because all of these things, I feel like we're on the path toward achieving. You know, you said you just turned 40. Well, you probably have 80 years or maybe even 100 years left in your life. There's a lot of progress to be made. So how do we manage this future shock without going completely crazy?
I think what you mentioned is going to happen, that people will go through mental health issues because they cannot digest what is happening to them. In general, it's harder and harder to simply live a normal life, nothing extraordinary, just to make sure that you get throughout the day, you can deal with the information overload that you get, you can deal with your job, you can raise a family, you can, you know, have a house, and just the basic elements of life, it's getting harder and harder to even keep up with them. And I'm not even talking about doing something extraordinary in someone's profession or in someone's personal lives or hobbies. That's step number one. But step number two is that the future shock has been around for decades. And whenever I feel like you, that things are becoming simply too overwhelming, then I switch back to not my book, but I have a quote in that from Alvin Toffler. He had a book about future shock. And I hope you don't mind if I just read this like three lines. This is from Alvin Toffler's book, The Third Wave. In a time when terrorists play death games with hostages, as currencies careen amid rumors of a third world war, as embassies flame and stormtroopers lace up their boots in many lands, we stare in horror at the headlines. The price of gold, that sensitive barometer of fear, breaks all records, banks tremble, inflation rages out of control, and the governments of the world are reduced to paralysis or imbecility. It was written in 1980. So when I feel like I'm being overwhelmed, I go back to that quote that the world seems to be like it has been the same for many decades now, but I don't want to underestimate the impact or the impacts of all these advanced technologies that these can have on us. So why I think it's crucial to deal with the future is that if you ask someone if they spend too much time thinking about the future, usually they become anxious. There's a saying that if someone spends too much time thinking about the past, they might become depressive. That nothing medical here, just a general observation. But people spending too much time about the future, thinking about the future, they might become anxious. There are so many reasons for that. None of us, nobody from the listeners has ever received training, as far as I know, about using futures methods. In school, all of us studied and learned history because we had history lessons. Plus, as a kid, we learned countless stories and legends and all this. So we, all of us, almost without exceptions, you know, if we were raised in a civilization, we are really good at drawing conclusions from stories and icons and legends. But when it comes to the future, simply we have no tools at our disposal. Only futurists or like economists and business management professionals learn these methods if they do courses about future studies. While I think we should spend almost the same amount of time teaching kids and adults how to deal with the future that the time we spent doing the same with the past. So instead of anxiety, what if by using these methods, we could create anticipatory consciousness? It means that, of course, I'm worried about the future, but why do I worry? I worry because I have no control over the future. That's not true. Or because the future is something that will come at me, and there is no way I could predict what is going to happen. Most people think that we futurists, we predict the future. And the more like more precise predictions I can come up with, the better futurist I am. But this idea implies that there is only one future. And whenever I start talking to people about analyzing the future, I always have to say out loud that multiple futures exist. And we have to acknowledge and understand and digest this line that multiple futures exist. So if you ask me, what is the future of this or that? Like, what is the future of using AI in medicine and healthcare? I have to ask, in which future? The future that would benefit the most, or that would be like a dystopian one, or the most optimal way? So which future are we talking about?
Your book promises that forward-thinking leaders who are going to read it are going to learn future methods and practical skills to help them become more forward-thinking or have the same practices as futurists. What are these methods that you're talking about?
Altogether, about 50 methods, plus minus 10, have been used by futurists worldwide, but I chose 6 as a starting package, and I still describe, besides those 6 basic methods, about 10 more. Just to give a picture about, you know, if these are the 6 ones that you can start using right away, but look at the horizon, how many other great methods exist out there. And I tried to create an order of these methods in a way that I think we move from the absolute simplest to a bit harder and harder, but still the sixth method is something that I think people can, at least the basics, they can learn the basics by reading the book. So for example, I love using the method called vision writing, which sounds like a simple exercise, yet if you start doing that, you realize how amazing it is to try to look at the world or a specific problem from the point of view of someone from the future. So in vision writing, what we do is that we try to create a scenario we are interested in. Like, for example, I want to learn more about the future of medical education. I would love to think about how the use of advanced technologies from generative AI models to virtual reality might impact the lives of medical students or professors like 10 years from now. So I have to come up with a situation, maybe a real world scenario, like 2035, we have a medical student who actually attends a medical school that uses a range of advanced technologies. And now the next step we can do is what kind of content we could write in the name, in the persona of that medical student. What would be the easiest one? Like a diary entry. So I write an entry describing my day as a medical student in 2035. Of course, I don't know what is going to happen 10 years from now, of course. Of course, maybe I'm not even a technological expert thinking about the future of medical education, but I can come up with some ideas about what potential technologies could play a role in the future of medical education. And I can try to get into the perspective of that medical student and focus on the experience that that student is having on that day. Or I want to learn more about the combination or the relationship between art and AI-made art. So I come up with a cultural festivals program from 2035 in which we will feature people, artists, and AI-based artistic works too. Or I usually, when I teach medical students, I ask them to write submit a written assignment as the final test for the course I teach to them about digital health and AI. And the assignment is about write a news headline from 2035 about a medical advanced technology going berserk. So sit down, come up with the technology, think about all the ethical, privacy, potential issues, challenges, and think about a very specific situation and just write what comes to mind. And the news headline should be the format that you are using because it gives you a freedom, but at the same time, it gives you a sort of security that this is the format that you know because you come across news headlines every single day. You know what is expected from you, 3-4 paragraphs about that situation. And sometimes students came back to me saying that it was a very hard exercise for them at first because they thought there was only one good answer. But as they started writing about the experience, they realized that the exercise is about spending time thinking about the future and not predicting whether it's going to happen or not. So vision writing, I think, is a great first step for anyone trying to get into the shoes of someone from the future. Or there is forecasting. And the reason why I love forecasting so much is that it's easy to practice it. Forecasting in general means that we have to provide the probability of the outcome of a very specific question. Like the question is, will the FDA have more than 2,000 approved AI-based medical devices by the end of 2026? That's a very, very precise question with only one or two outcome, yes or no. And I have to provide the probability between 0% and 100%. And the reason why I love that method so much is that I don't expect people to come up with these precise questions right away, but they can use a free community site that I've been using for over a decade called the Good Judgment Project. At GJP, they will come across a very supportive community. It's absolutely free to take part in the forecasting exercises, and they will find hundreds of questions from culture to the Grammy Award winners, Oscar winners, to sport, geopolitics, technology, healthcare, anything you can imagine. And you can start providing probabilities for the outcomes of those questions. And if you do it, of course, more and more often, it will become easier and easier to think about how can I get new information about that? Or what if I have a probability about something I have knowledge about, like who is going to win the best directing award at the Oscars? And then I come across new information. Am I flexible enough to change my forecasts? Or it also teaches you how to address a question properly. Like my favorite example about this is that if you show a photo of a newlywed couple to someone and you ask them, what is the probability that this newlywed couple will divorce in 5 years? then most people who have never done forecasting exercises before would say that almost 0% because they look happy on the wedding photo. But of course, everyone looks happy, ideally, on their wedding photo. So a good forecaster would ask, all right, what is the zip code where this couple got married? Because this is the baseline. We will see what divorce rate we find on that zip code in the next 5 years, and then we will start from there. We will fine-tune it, of course, with every detail we find, but that's where we start. So if you learn these granular changes or the way you can improve your skill of forecasting one by one, and it's such a fun experience and a very supportive process. So I stop here, but these are the first two methods I come up with in the book.
Can you talk about some of the benefits that people will realize when they become more of a future thinking leader?
What a nice question to ask, actually. I think that definitely the first thing that is that whenever I talk to people about the future, I always feel the anxiety. But if you start using these methods and you start realizing that multiple futures exist, I don't have to predict what is going to happen, but I can observe what could happen. I can even choose the ones, the kinds of futures I would prefer for myself. So it is indeed possible to turn that anxiety into anticipatory consciousness. The second is about the competitive advantage of strategies. I love what Hermann Kahn did. He was the one coming up with the first scenario analysis back in the 1950s. And later he started transforming that method into something companies can use. And he had a very, as he said, a fun exercise with the Shell Corporation back then. And the exercise was about scenario analysis of what might happen with oil prices. And if this or that happens, then how would you change your strategy? And 3 years later, in 1973, there was a big oil crisis. And only one company had a strategy for what actually happened. And that was Shell, because of that fun exercise with Hermann Kahn about scenario analysis. Of course, since then, many companies and governments have adopted the method. But if you know how to use even the most basic versions or alternatives of this method, you will realize that you don't have to know what is going to happen. But by knowing what could happen, following the rules and values that matter to you the most or matter to you about the outcome that you're looking for, then you immediately start creating strategies. And still, by creating strategies for these scenarios, it doesn't mean that you will always get it right. But I guarantee that it will give you some mental comfort, knowing that I don't know what is going to happen, but I'm prepared for many potential outcomes out there. And maybe the third one would be just around the idea that if I can choose what kind of future I prefer for my team, company, family, or personal lives, then I might get into a better position of actually having an impact on that. So you start realizing that out of the multiple futures that exist, I choose this one and I can backcast. So if I want that future out of the many, what can I do from today in legal, personal, practical, technological, social terms to have a better chance to reach that future? So immediately I start having an impact on having a better chance to reach that desired future. So the future is not something that will come at me. It's something I am influencing right now. But if I can influence it and you can influence it, maybe we have a shared vision, then again, all of a sudden, we are working towards a commonly shared goal. And to me, it sounds like we are just bringing hope into our lives that the world can become better because we have a shared vision, we understand where we are going, and we are working right now in the practical reality of today, step by step, to reach that desired future.
What can you tell us about the psychology of thinking about the future?
There was a study in Chicago analyzing what percentage of thoughts a general person has a day by day, what percentage goes into that day or the next day, next month, next year, years later, and only an absolute minority of our thoughts are about the, not far-fetched, but are about even the future in a few years from today. And that's something, it's a very important observation because that's the baseline we are starting from. But if we learn a few tricks, and the tricks would include like building a relationship with our future selves. Again, not future self, but selves, because there are multiple future selves existing, of course, like in the case of multiple futures. To me personally, this has given me the largest range of tools to deal with the future. just to build a relationship with my future self. So whenever I have to make an important decision, it's not just me thinking about that, but I'm having an active discussion with my future self and we are making deals. Of course, I cannot take every single task from him. So I cannot outsource everything from my today into the future. I cannot make my tomorrow self situation worse than what I have today. So we are making deals. Look, I will do this or that, but the next task is going to be assigned to you tomorrow or next week or next month. And I show that in the book, there are many studies showing that if people tend to procrastinate more, then they also tend to have a worse relationship with their future selves. And they might have a worse ability for empathy. So in general, I think what is very beneficial for all of us is to start creating a relationship with our future selves, which I have to mention also includes dealing with our past selves. If you don't have a sort of good relationship with your past selves, it's going to be much more challenging to deal with your future selves too. And it's not something that futurists have come up with or something that I invented myself. If you watch the 2014 Oscar acceptance speech from Matthew McConaughey, you will see the same perspective. He said that there are three things in his life: one thing to look up to, one thing to look forward to, and one thing to chase. And for him, the third thing, one thing to chase was himself 10 years later. And when he was asked 10 years later whether he was finally able to catch that guy, he said, no, not even close. So my next hero is going to be myself in 10 years from now, and again, 10 years again and again. But it's his future self that he has been chasing throughout his life. And I think it's a very positive way of looking at life and trying to be better, trying to grow as a person.
I know you as the medical futurist, and we're talking about the future in general, but I'm curious to know, what are two or three recent medical advances that fill you with optimism?
The reason why it's a hard question to ask is that as the medical futurist, I might be expected to come up with, stem cell therapies and regeneration therapies and all this. But what I've recently started becoming much more interested in is the practical side of longevity. So for decades, longevity research, has been on the table. We have been learning so much about genetics, epigenetics, and maybe a miracle drug could come in a few years or decades, a bit more potentially. But year by year, I started not believing in that so much. What I believe in now more is that we have now a practical side of longevity. So every year I have a very dedicated primary care physician, and since I became the medical futurist, I've been testing a range of digital health, wearable devices, AI-based technologies, genetic services, you name it, I've tested them for a reason. I wanted to understand, what challenges patients or physicians go through, or how developers and inventors might come across obstacles while they're creating a product for patients and physicians. So I've been doing all that. But for about 7 or 8 years, every January, I sit down with my primary care physician to create a preventive plan. And I think this is the year when we came to the realization that some of the screenings I will do this year is part of me becoming 40. All right. Some of the supplements I take is about general sense about health and healthy lifestyle. But now we have a practical side of longevity. Things I can start doing from today to have a chance for at least a life until 80 or 100 in a general, good stage of health. And I'm very happy to dedicate a lot of resources to that. So not just time and energy, but even money, my own privacy, sometimes my blood or other tissue samples from my body. I'm happy to do that because I want to have a chance for a long and healthy life. So that's now the practical side of longevity. And I think there have been a few recent breakthroughs, not in the way in life sciences or research, but in the way the general public thinks about longevity. And I think Brian Johnson has been doing an important job in that respect. Dr. Attia's book, Outlive, is another great example. Even Eric Topol now came up with a book about longevity, as far as I know, or what we can do about all that coming out this year. So it seems that the walls of mainstream are being broken down by the practical examples of longevity. And maybe it's not just about healthy lifestyle anymore, but a bit more than that. Because of course, we have been knowing for decades what kind of unhealthy habits we should avoid doing in our lives, from smoking to alcohol or not moving, not exercising enough. But it seems like we haven't won that challenge, right? Because still billions, if not just hundreds of millions, but billions of people are still doing many of these unhealthy habits. So we have to raise the stakes here and start persuading people that it's one thing to think about living a healthy lifestyle today, but if you could have better deals with your future selves, then what you actually do is that you're building a longevity, a potential for longevity for your next decades or so. And that would definitely be a new perspective for billions out there.
And it's not just making it to the future, but making it and being healthy. That future self is going to be pretty disappointed about your choices today. And so if you think about these types of decisions that you make on a day-to-day basis with your future self in mind, you're very likely going to make some healthier choices.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you were saying that. The other day I had a short discussion with my future self. Like I'm 40, I started to think about myself at 80, and literally, you know, I can count like how many gym sessions I would have until then. So I sort of asked my future self, how would you feel about you being able to say that I have done like 50,000, you know, like 30,000 gym sessions just because you can be here at the age of 80 with that level of lifestyle and health and everything. And it made my future self so proud, and it felt good to me that one day I might be able to say that. And of course, maybe some people think I'm crazy a little bit about, you know, discussing this thing with the future self. Maybe I won't even live until then. Maybe I will live to 100. I don't know. But what matters to me is that if my 80 years old self could say that I'm proud of you, my 40-year-old self, it would make me absolutely happy and satisfied. So I will keep on doing that until I can reach that stage.
Percy, I'm telling you, the part about the future self and the psychology of future thinking is the most important part of your book, as far as I'm concerned. I've read a bunch about the future and forecasting and you know, being a futurist, but this part of your book is so, so important. And so as I think about it, I don't just think about my future self, but I think about my future selves. Relationships with my daughters and their community. And I think that's so important. And so that's really, really motivating. I don't want to just make it to 100. I want to make it to 100 and be able to travel with my daughters will be in their 60s probably, or late 50s. So I'm quite a bit older than they are. And that is what inspires me to do a lot of the things and make a lot of the choices that I'm making today. So what you've done in that part of the book is so, so important. And I can't stress that enough.
It warms my heart so much. Thank you so much for saying that. To be honest with you, the one thought that made me make the decision to write this book when I didn't even know what exactly I will include in the book was while I was at a running session and I was started thinking about if I'm a good enough parent. And it was a very important discussion with my present self, of course. And I had to come to the conclusion that, well, let's play out, let's use vision writing. What if my daughter is 18, so her brother is 11, and they're having a discussion about me, like what kind of experiences they had when they were 8 and 1. And of course I have data on that because I live with them, so I know what kind of things we are doing together, from homework to fun stuff, how we love video games because I love them, and baseball and stuff like that. So I had data and I started creating these discussions. And of course, I cannot know now what they will discuss then, but I can guess. And based on how I guessed, I started coming up with ideas about what more I could do with them now. So then they might even be happier about having me as a father back then. Hopefully I will be alive then. So we will have even more newer experiences then. But that was my way of thinking. And I was very happy about it because it gives you a sense of timelessness, no matter how weird it sounds, in the age of short-term thinking. And what I love about because timelessness is not something futurists have come up with. It's called the wakapapa in the Maori culture. It has been around for centuries, if not millennia. And the idea is that the generations before me and after me and this generation right now, we are working together. We are hand in hand working for the greater good. And I'm nothing without my past generations, without my ancestors, and I will be nothing without impacting my future generations. So all this should be in our minds by making decisions in politics, in geopolitics, in personal lives, in hobbies. All this comes together when we understand that we are not just in one point of history, but we are having an influence on what will come after us if we acknowledge this timelessness aspect of our relationship with time.
As you know, I've shifted my career a little bit to focus on helping older adults age in place. I'm curious to know what you think we're getting wrong about aging.
Regarding aging, we have come a long way. If just look at, like, from the 1980s, the last four decades, and what we have achieved regarding life expectancy or the number of years spent in a healthy stage, I think it's extraordinary what medicine and healthcare and life science have been able to achieve. Of course, it's never enough, especially when we get older and we start having health issues and, you know, the end of life comes closer. It's never enough, but I think we have to say out loud that it has been an incredible journey. And just imagine what more we will be able to achieve by using now generative AI models that can discuss ideas or find new research directions, or even actually do some of the research that we still don't have enough human power to do. So it's exciting to think about that kind of future. The part I'm more worried about is the not the moment, the kinds of years we are living through right now. I'm trying to explain myself. I mean that the technological evolution behind healthcare is so amazing that no matter from what perspective I look at that as a futurist, I always look at the kind of evolution that will lead to replacing repetitive tasks or automation becoming a member of the medical team. So now patients, physicians, and AI sitting at the same medical team, or how patients will become the point of care, how it will lead to healthcare becoming more globalized, thus more accessible for populations, all this. But the moment that you're living in right now is sort of, it seems to be like at the breaking point, that now physicians have to use electronic medical records, which makes them do more administration, so they have less time with patients. But if that technological evolution could go on, we get to voice-to-text applications based on AI. So what discussions patients are having with physicians, everything is written down, and the physician can keep that conversation with eye-to-eye contact and showing empathy and compassion with the patient, while they only have to check and reconfirm everything that was written down at the end of the session. But we have to take a few more steps in technological evolution to get to that point when we can finally release the tension and the burden on physicians and patients. And I worry that whether we can survive that few years in the middle of the digital health paradigm shift, and people won't lose hope that healthcare can become better, because it can if we keep on doing these things the right way. And that's what I worry about aging too, that if we can survive this and start using advanced technologies for the benefits of patients, from exoskeletons to generative AI model that can serve like a healthcare navigator for patients, helping to make hundreds of decisions and lifestyle choices every day, then we get to a stage where aging will be supported by advanced technologies, and not that we have to make as individuals a decision between using or being able to access technologies or not at all, so we have no say in how we will age later on.
I'm curious to know if you have a vision for the future of aging.
I cannot make a distinction here between the future of healthcare and the future of aging, because to me, the future of aging means that I am, as an aging individual, I'm absolutely part of healthcare, because without healthcare, how could I take care of myself? How could I keep up healthy habits? How could I monitor conditions or treat them or cure some of them?
Do you believe that it's possible to suspend aging or even reverse aging? There's been some discussion around that. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on that.
The exercise of forecasting is always about asking the right question. I think that's a question that no one can answer. If the question is more about whether I see a higher chance of you as an individual getting access to your medical records, digital health devices, services, genetic tests, AI-based services, all this would give you a higher chance for a long and healthy life, or you could achieve the same by getting a miracle drug that could reverse aging, I would put 97% on the first and 3% on the letter. And I'm not a pessimistic type of researcher about all the things that we can achieve in reverse aging. I just see that it's so much easier to achieve the same with the whole digital health paradigm shift and by involving AI as the newest member of the medical team than waiting for a miracle drug to arrive, maybe in a few decades from now. But what if I keep on waiting for that miracle drug that will reverse my aging, but until then I lose so much power from my potentials of having a healthy lifestyle that maybe it will be even late, too late when I start taking that miracle drug?
You have to dual track it. You have to do both. No doubt you have to do both.
We have both, of course, that's the better. It means we have the miracle drug, but we can still live a healthy life by using advanced technologies, and healthcare is a partner in all that. It sounds like an idea future to me.
When I look back 50 years to 1975, I know we made a ton of mistakes and we're making a ton of mistakes in 2025. I'm curious to know, and you can pick any domain, you don't have to pick healthcare or aging or medicine, but I'm curious to know what you think the people of 2075 are going to look back at what we're doing today and just shake their heads at in disbelief.
Such a thoughtful question to ask. My answer would be something more from a more like a bird's eye view perspective. And that's about, if you look back from 2040, I think what we will find with people in 2025 is that they had no idea how to deal with the whole automation evolution. They had no idea how to deal with the age of deepfake. And these people started to lose trust in the whole system around them, which is, to me, essentially means losing hope. And if we lose hope, then we cannot solve anything in life, in the world, in about geopolitics, about tensions, about conflicts, because hope is the one thing that helped us understand and solve everything from the civil rights movement to voting rights, from COVID-19 vaccines to building and achieving amazing things like the International Space Station. We had hope that life could get better, so let's keep on progressing and building something amazing. And there is a risk now because of short-term thinking, because of instant gratification, because of how the people of 2025 think that they have no control over their future. Everything is happening above our heads and shoulders. I think there is a risk of losing hope. And hopefully, that's my hope, that we won't make that mistake. And we will. And I, of course, it's just my personal belief, but I do believe that the solution somewhere lies around creating a new relationship with the future, being able to analyze the potential futures, choose the ones we like the most. Just let me give you just one practical example about that. I'm a general citizen. I will vote for somebody in the next election in my country. If I had a better relationship with the future, if I could start having discussions with my future self, can you imagine how it would change my perspective on the next politician's speeches? Whether they would address the issues I am worried about, whether I would see that they absolutely understand that we are not just building for the next term, a country or a community, we are building for the next generation. It starts with the next term, but we have to be able to look beyond that too. And I need you as my leader, my political leader. I need to see that you understand that and be on the same page about that. So if people start acknowledging the future from this new perspective, if they start being able to analyze that with their own methods, I think it completely changes the game from how we choose politicians, from to how we lead countries, how we create organizations, which organizations or companies' products we trust with our lives, with our data, with our privacy. And that game-changing aspect or paradigm shift would be enough for me to give hope again that people will know better because they know the future better.
Bercy, where can people learn more about you and where can they buy your map to the future?
I'm very active on medicalfuturist.com and on all the social media channels. We are called the Medical Futurist. And your map to the future, you'll find it on yourmaptothefuture.com, essentially on Amazon marketplaces around the world. And it makes sense to look for the marketplace closest to your location for better shipping and prices.
Bercy, thank you for your time and thank you again for being a genius.
Thank you for listening to 12 Geniuses. We will be back in 2 weeks when I interview one of my great mentors and friends, Doug Lenick. Doug's company, Think to Perform, has been conducting one of the world's most comprehensive studies on personal values. We discuss what has been learned from this study and how values are remarkably consistent regardless of where people live, their cultural backgrounds, or any other demographic differences. In short, what people value is universal, and our values can be a unifying force for humanity. It promises to be a rich conversation. Thanks for listening, and thank you for being a genius.